been. I'm here to tell you about the destruction of all the evil it will have to end. To stay alive.
That's the great Nina Simone performing Revolution, one of her signature protest songs, live at the Harlem Cultural Festival in 1969. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are doing a series of programs on a concatenation, as it seems, of legal events in cases that have sparked protest and great activity in the African-American Latino communities in particular, but in communities of conscience generally, over the matter of police use of force, police brutality, police killings of civilians. We've talked about the case of Freddie Gray, and we did so in the context of the prosecution of six police officers, begins in the city of Baltimore. We talked about the case of Aquan McDonald. This is a particularly troubling case. We saw the videotape. In this case, one police officer, Jason Van Dyke, faces charges of first-degree murder, and we are monitoring that. And today we're taking a look at two other cases, the case of Tamir Rice. This was a 12-year-old boy who was playing in a park with a gun, a toy gun, in the city of Cleveland. A report is called in to the police of somebody playing with a gun. The report also was careful to point out that it may not be a real gun and that the person with this toy gun, or the gun that may not be a real gun, does not appear to be a grown person, appears to be a boy. Police come on the scene, and within seconds, Tamir Rice was shot dead. We're also going to be talking about the case of Jamar Clark. This is a case out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and this is also a very troublesome case for reasons that we will explain today in the course of our discussion. It's important for us to understand these cases this way, and this way means that we get into the legal system, not just what the media are saying, not just the popular knowledge of what we think has happened, but we are trying to get to the nuts and bolts of things, the legal mechanisms that are in play, so that we have an entirely different appreciation of how these cases historically have been dealt with, what statistically it looks like in terms of the current or contemplated prosecutions. And we get a sense of what is the relationship, the power relationship between these communities from which the inordinately from which the victims of police brutality, this kind of brutality, come, and the system that seems to protect them. So this is where we're going. We are very, very fortunate indeed to have as our legal analyst Alton H. Maddox, Jr., who I have called a long time ago the People's Attorney General. He has been that for almost 40 years, principally in the city of New York, but not exclusively in the city of New York, trying cases always pro bono, always without a fee, in the interest of the class of oppressed people, because these cases represent the condition of a class of people, and that's how I have known him for almost 40 years now, dealing with the legal system fearlessly in this way and scoring major, major legal precedents along the way, setting them and scoring major legal victories. So he continues with us today, and Alton, I thank you for being with us once more.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the invitation again, Utrecht, because, as I've always done from day one in New York, is try to educate the community, because there's so much that we don't know, and that is what is frightening. And I always say there are two stages to education. The first stage is remedial education. And afterwards, the second stage is continuing education. And we're not doing well on either. And as I, think about from yesterday to today, just in the Chicago case, I mean, there's been major headlines, that really somewhat, put you back to revisiting those issues in Chicago before we even try to get to Cleveland, Ohio, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. And just to add to that, there was a front page article today in the New York Times talking about an affirmative action case and how what is going on these college campuses could have a major impact on that particular ruling. And the reason I bring that up is because in past spring, I asked some members, or in fact the whole membership of the Freedom Party, to begin to outline and the possibilities of us filing an amicus curiae brief. And I may have well been speaking Greek, because nobody did anything. And that is what is frustrating when you see these things happening and then nobody take any action. And when you take action, as I tried to do in Sandra Bland and some other cases, then either you're going to pay all of the expenses yourself or it just won't get done. And I really can't understand our thinking. And I simply bring out to people who think, well, you shouldn't be criticizing your own people. Well, if I was a member of the SCLC back in 1967, and I heard some members in the SCLC talk about they won't help assassinate Dr. King, does that mean that I should keep quiet and let that happen? Or does that mean that back in 1964, if I heard some members who were associated with Malcolm X said, well, we're going to knock out Malcolm, does that mean if I said anything, I don't know why he shouldn't keep his mouth shut? I mean, that's the kind of reasoning that is going on in our community. So as we're trying to educate our community and try to lead it forward, then we also have the backward-minded people in our community who want to take us back, and seemingly their argument is attracting a lot of people. And that it's unfortunate when we can't think. And when you have somebody who is promoting fallacies in the vanguard of our own community. So, I just want to get that off my chest. In terms of trying to be a legal analyst, I don't think people to understand that, one, you have costs in terms of making this broadcast possible. And for several years now, I've been asking people to make contributions for me continuing to write and have the legal software and other matters that would improve my even just being a legal analyst without even getting in the possibility of going back into the practice of law. And even that is not happening. So, you know, as we get ready to take off into 2016, the forecast is very gloomy, and hopefully many of us will be intelligent enough to pull out our boots and to get our rain gear ready and our umbrellas so that we can withstand the storm. And for me to do that, I'm just simply announcing today, I won't be going in detail, but I will be doing an extensive workshop to try to obtain the tools and the equipment that is necessary for me to be able to appear on your program and other programs to really make a meaningful contribution to where we are. And so people should circle December 19th of this year because we really got to get going. There's just too much happening just even overnight for us to think that you can just pop up the next day and be ready. And you can't be ready, and I can't be ready. And the only way that we can really serve our community is to have that tools and that equipment that makes us, allow us to inform our community in a way that they can withstand the storm.
Well, let's just look at this case. Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy who was playing with a pellet gun, or it looked, some people said, like a real gun, but he was a boy playing in a public park. A report comes in, the police respond, and within a matter of seconds, Officer Timothy Lohman shoots him. He dies a day later. This was on November the 22nd, 2014, when this incident occurred. All that time has passed. We had the similar routine being followed here about the an offer to settle the case civilly, and the family and the family's attorneys, I think, were amenable to that. But now comes a question of battling reports, individual reports. The family had hired some people to analyze the situation, analyze the tapes that were made available. The prosecutor has its set of reports. And now we are caught into this battle of reports. But am I crazy here to say that what is the battle really about? This is not about reports. And reports, have reached a stage where reports, a family who has suffered the loss of a loved one, especially in this way, is now expected, if you're African American or Latino, you now must go and hire your own investigators in order to force the system to do its job. Is this where we are now?
Well, actually, for those of us in New York, we're even farther behind than that. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I have tried to inform those of us here and in many other parts of the country that grand jury reform is absolutely critical. Because we are dealing with a secret proceeding administered by the criminal justice system and supported by a secret society, and that is the ends of court that came to us here in this country from England. There and the Star Chamber as well. So, you know, it's a lot of historical issues here, but it definitely sounds crazy. But when you go back into the history, it's even crazier than that. And, you know, that's what I was talking about, how so much time is really needed to really address these issues in ways that our people can understand it. But the good side in terms of Ohio is that they permit the reports. The bad side in New York is that these reports are inadmissible. And so what happens in a state like New York, if the prosecution has exculpatory materials, materials that tend to suggest that you may be innocent, the prosecution has no obligation to submit that material at all. And so the stakes even become worse because now you're having to face an indictment in which there are overcharges in the indictment. And when you get to court, looking at the indictment and what you've been charged with and the possibility of life imprisonment or whatever the possibility might be, then you may tend to plead guilty despite the fact that there's some exculpatory material that wasn't ever mentioned in the first place. So to that extent, you know, we're talking about grand jury reform here, and that's what I was talking about earlier when I was talking about, you know, the possibility of raising some money for us to get ready for that, and the possibility of me having a real support system, not people who are there to just try to impede whatever I'm doing. So
But I want to ask this question because it raises the possibility here of, I think, prosecutorial misconduct or some certain illegality. I can't find any identification with the prosecutor's notion that these reports, whether the reports were undertaken by his office or the police department or whoever, or the family for that matter, the fact is his job is not to produce reports. His job is to determine not even innocence or guilt. The reports should not be used to determine innocence or guilt at this time. The reports should basically augment the process, but not be the process. The job here is to decide whether there is reason based on evidence, not just reports, but based on evidence, forensic evidence, whether there is enough reason to link the officer, the offending officer, patrolman Lohman, with the killing of this 12-year-old boy, and begin the process of indictment. I don't understand why there is this logjam over reports.
Well, again, you know, when you are a defense attorney, you know, you certainly want to make your client appear to be in the best light. And the tragedy is that in this grand jury process, you have the problem of the process itself. And so the question becomes, you know, on one hand, as you say, you're looking for prima facie evidence of the possibility that somebody may have committed a crime, and this is the particular defendant that may have done it or the suspect that may have done it. But, you know, when you get involved in the actual struggle, you realize that the prosecutor is not making a fair presentation. I mean, that really becomes the issue in terms of your obligation to do something. Because the law allows the prosecutor to make a bias and a unfair presentation of the evidence. And so the question becomes, you know, in terms of what the prosecutor is really obligated to do in terms of just simply starting the indictment process.
But even now, the police officer who's to be, in my mind, the target of prosecution, this is Officer Lohman, Timothy Lohman, that officer, as well as his partner who was with him at the time of this shooting, Frank Garmbach, neither of them appears to have really been questioned by the prosecutor. And we have only this week the first inkling, their first, I would say, a formal response to any charge that might be lodged against him. This is Lohmann. And he writes his response. I'm sure the law probably allows that, but isn't it odd that more than a year later, these officers have not gone through rigorous questioning? They certainly not by the prosecutor, that they're allowed to enter a statement, and the statement stands for their version of the facts. And these reports by the hired hands to that said that the officer shot within, you know, that phrase, within acceptable and legal departmental guidelines, and that's where we are. So, in other words, everything so far is shaping up to excuse or to basically remove any blame at all from the police officer, although there are other facts that should have become evident by now to question this.
Well, you see, you're absolutely right, and I'm not quarreling with your conclusion at all. What I'm simply saying that when you allow, for example, a police officer to submit or file a written report or a written statement, then you have gone beyond the common limits of decency, because that in itself has to be defined as naked hearsay, which is virtually worthless. You know, and then the question becomes whether you actually charge the jury consistent with that naked hearsay and let the jurors know that this statement has virtually no value in the law itself. And so you're dealing with a situation here where, you know, a lot of people, and I've certainly been one of those who have argued that you really shouldn't have a grand jury at all, because the problem is that, you know, whatever the result is, it is secret, and it is not to be given to the litigants, or certainly not to be given to the defendant. The prosecution obviously has an upside on this because the prosecution is aware of the kind of presentation that was made to the grand jury, but the defendant is not aware of that presentation, and that's where the inequality comes in.
But right from the outset, and it's so blatant in my view, we have the position, it has not been expressed in words, but we have the position in terms of the actions and reactions on the part of the prosecutor that essentially this is not about whether a crime has been committed here, but this is about whether departmental procedures were followed. And so we come back to this question again. Which dominates? Is this a departmental issue, or is this a litigation and prosecution of a crime?
Well, the police department and virtually any department in the nation, and certainly most of the targets of those investigations, meaning the suspects, would like for it to be reduced to a departmental investigation. So that would enable them a lot of wiggle room in terms of pointing fingers at other people, as the mayor of Chicago just did overnight, you know, and so therefore it expands the number of suspects without actually zeroing in on any suspects and therefore causing mass confusion. So you're right in the sense that the strategy is to create mass confusion, and reducing this to a departmental trial is one of those procedures.
The city of Cleveland approved $3 million to settle this case. And I'm confused. It's another case. I'm looking at my notes from another case. The Cuyahoga County Sheriff's Department, this is the one that is looking at this case, as Officer Timothy Lohman should have been and should still be the target of prosecution here. His partner, Frank Garnback, apparently has not yet been questioned sufficiently to determine whether he should be a target of prosecution. He did not shoot Tamir Rice, but he was there. And one would assume that by not exercising due restraint of his partner, he has to answer for his role in the death of Tamir Rice. But Mother Jones magazine was reporting that in the same week that the sheriff was announcing that the investigation into Tamir's death was almost complete, Mother Jones was saying that they had not even questioned Lohman or Garnback, his partner, up until that time. What does that say to you?
Well, what it says to me is that in any procedure, the best offense is to have a wild card. And so what Cleveland is doing is making the officer who is a witness, but not necessarily a suspect, the wild card in terms of coming in at some stage and exonerating his partner from any criminal culpability. And so from the policeman's standpoint, you know, that is always good because when you have a large number of potential suspects and you only zero in on one or two, that frees the other to change their testimony in a way that would enable them to free the targets from any criminal liability.
And only now is there a vigorous call for an independent prosecutor from the family's lawyers. Do you think that this has a prayer?
Well, you know, I think that just simply calling for a special prosecutor doesn't have a prayer at all. You know, and that's why I always say that you, first of all, you don't wait. You start your investigation immediately to compile the evidence that is necessary to shoo the district attorney's office away from the case. And so, you know, the longer that you wait and the longer you keep your mouth shut and only ask for a special prosecutor but do no investigation, the worse it is in terms of you actually securing a special prosecutor. And in addition to that, you know, I remember at some point, some time ago, you know, that was really questions as to whether from the beginning there should be a call for an impeachment of a judge, you know, that I wrote on, and it didn't get any traction then, but it should have, because this whole process in terms of grand juries and all of that are supervised by judges. And so, you know, if there's some tort efforts in place to help the police officer, those judges should be identified immediately. And most of the time, they're never identified at all. And certainly, it becomes incumbent upon somebody in the defense to say, well, look, we got to start trying to impeach these judges. And so that's where these problems come in, because now you have lawyers who are not representing a class. They're representing a family. And then when they start making calls that steps on the toes of judges, it would take a class of people and not a family to protect the lawyer. And that's the reason why I say all the time that these criminal prosecutions are invariably a class action. I mean, that's the only way you can look at them. They have to be perceived as a class action, and the community has to be part of that process from the beginning, because the things that lawyer would have to do to move them from defense attorneys to a private attorney general or people's attorney general or whatever the case might be will become missing. I mean, these are very life and death situations, and when you get started, where you start immediately misfiring, you got these kind of problems. I mean, you can learn a lot from just what happened in Chicago. You know, if you're sitting over there in Cleveland, because there are several people in Chicago that should be behind bars today. And we're not calling for any of that. And the only thing that they threw us was the firing of the police chief, you know, as the bone to hope pacify us and enable us to keep quiet. But this is a real game of chess, and we have to appreciate it and take it seriously.
Well, similarly here in the case of Cleveland, I mean, just a matter of days before Tamir Rice was killed, the city of Cleveland approved a $3 million settlement with several African-American victims and their families of police brutality and even police killings. You may recall the killing of Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams, a couple just driving down the street. Their car backfires, and somebody thought it was that the occupants of the vehicle were shooting at the police. The car backfired as they passed a station house. And the end result was that Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams were shot 137 times. Remember that horrific case?
Sure.
Now, this case wasn't the thing. This case hasn't even been prosecuted.
Right.
And yet, you know, we see the pattern over and over and over again, so that even in a situation where we are talking about life and death, it doesn't seem as if the response takes on the urgency in terms of the legal strategies that are involved and the legal actions by the attorneys involved representing the families. This is no child's play here. This is very serious. And yet we have the insanity of more than a year going by with this case that got so much coverage, and yet the officers have not yet been questioned, let alone indicted.
Well, you see, the one thing that I have tried to explain to people is that everything in this country is based on systems. The critical word is systems.
And I say that all the time.
Right. And, you know, you talk about a business system, an economic system, a legal system. You're talking about systems. And the four common traits that I have identified as being a part of every system is the word acronym HELP. And that means history, ethics, logic, and philosophy. Those are the common traits that are always involved in every system, and we have to understand that because the people that run this country are not going to make it easy for us, you know, so that we can have some kind of overnight revelation about where we need to go tomorrow. That's not going to happen. So you're dealing with these systems. Now, inside of those four common traits is the trait of philosophy. Now, American jurisprudence is based on natural law. And under natural law, hush money has no place. And that's why, you know, we don't understand how dangerous it is for some lawyers to be feasting off of hush money, because hush money is not a part of the equation. And so when you go to law school and you take a course in torts, and you take a course in criminal law, the normal process is if you're involved, for example, in a wrongful death, like in the case of O.J. Simpson, the normal process is to first make sure that person go to jail. That's first and foremost. Nothing else, right then and there, first thing you do is to make sure the person go to jail. Now, that is what is taught in law school. Now, after the criminal process has taken its place, the next step is to sue under tort law for wrongful death. And you move from there. Now, I'll give you a very a clear example of that, and one that people probably look at all day long and laugh about and never seem to be able to connect the dots, is the case of O.J. Simpson. When O.J. Simpson was charged, he was not charged with tort law. He was charged with criminal law, and the object was to put O.J. behind bars. And so that's how the process works. That's how people are taught. So, you know, when a lawyer comes to you and starts talking about hush money, then if you are a slave, then, that, you know, you'll fall for it. If you're not a slave, you'll say, no, I want justice first. You know, and then we talk about hush money later. And so here you are in a situation, O.J., where they tried to convict. Fortunately for him, his own community came forward and said, no, you know, we don't believe those charges, and they had to acquit him. Now, they turn around nonetheless and still sue for wrongful death. They got a verdict in wrongful death, but they kept their eyes on the prize because they knew that regardless of this, this Negro got to go to jail. And now O.J. Simpson is behind bars. I mean, that's how the process works. Even when it gets waylaid, you know, they get back on track from the derailment and go right back after you. And so, you know, the idea that we are sitting here taking hush money for these cases is criminal. And what you find out is that the U.S. Supreme Court ushered in hush money in the case of State Bar of Arizona versus Bates. And that is what really gave the signal for Black folks to be caught trying to get hush money instead of justice. So it became a very attractive, and now you got all these advertising out here on every television station talking about how much money this lawyer can bring, get you, how much money that lawyer can get you, and all of that. And Black folks ain't thinking about justice no more. All they want now is hush money. Now, the end result of hush money is just what it suggests. What has happened to the Central Park 7? Have anybody heard from them recently? You know, and they took it, and that's what you're supposed to do when you take hush money. So, you know, now we got a problem where we're trying to fight the notion of hush money, and at the same time, some of us are trying to pursue justice. You know, and that's why, you know, this lawyer down there in Florida, you know, is in the New York Times today with Hillary Clinton, all right? You know, because they understand the value of hush money, and they understand the value of promoting lawyers who sell out. And so if you get the
Well, you know, one of
today,
the things we should point out, one of the things when families settle, it is absolutely imperative that they give up the right to any further legal action, and they have to hold the people who did their loved ones in harmless. They have to say, it's okay, all is forgiven. We'll forget this, that you shot and killed my son. We'll forget that you did these wrongs, and we'll just move on.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's exactly what happened. And what is important is none of this is taught in law school to white people. You know, only Negroes settle for hush money and promoting hush money and trying to derail the road to justice. You know, and you know, I can say this very clearly. I have always, every case I ever got involved in, did exactly as I was taught in law school. And that was to go after the person who caused the harm first. And whether that's Howard Beach or Tawana Brawley or whoever it is, go after that person first. And so that's the reason why I don't practice law today, because New York said, well, hey, if you want to practice law, you got to forget about Stephen Pagonis. I said, well, I don't want to practice law, because that wasn't what you taught me in law school. You taught me to go after the culprit first. Stephen Pagonis is the culprit. He's been proven to be the culprit. Now, we can't talk any longer about me practicing law or anything else if we're going to let these culprits get away, because if they're not punished, they're going to do it again. And that's really why it is repetitive in our community today that these people are constantly doing it and redoing it, because we are taking hush money, forgiving them for their actions. And it's like forgiving a lion for killing a zebra. You put him back out in the jungle, and he's going to kill another zebra. And that's natural law. And that's why that's the philosophy. We are not even following the philosophy of American jurisprudence.
What happens now? Let's finish this program on this particular issue, and we will, so as not to shortchange the Jamar Clark case, we'll return to him tomorrow. But let's talk about this case of Tamir Rice. From your perspective, what should concern us about this case from a legal perspective?
Well, you know, as you said before, what really should concern us about this case is that we're going to have to retool as a community and realize, you know, that the only way that you can win these cases over any period of time is to pursue it in a way that Chief Justice Roger Taney wrote but did not mean that it was applied to us, and that is that it has to be an action by a class. And, you know, when you have an action by a class, it's quite different than having an action by a lawyer. I mean, the things that I was able to do only as a lawyer, setting myself up for my demise. Because that's not the process. There's only way to do these kinds of cases when the facts are similar and when the target is the same. You have a class action, and you have to proceed as a class action, and you have to dismiss any laws to the contrary. You know, don't worry about what they tell you the law is. The law underlying these cases is a class action, and you have to take it as a class. You have to be involved in the court process. You have to intervene where necessary to take certain actions and to keep the case on track. I mean, this is what you do in a legal case. You know, people put out there two litigants on both sides of the law, and they go after each other, and the judge and the community have to be there to make sure that the game is played fairly. I mean, that's the only way. And when they realize that this is a class action, that all the people of Cleveland are thoroughly upset, backed up by the 40 million plus blacks in the United States, then you start getting some results. As long as we continue with habit evidence, and that means the teachings of our slave masters, because we all victims of that. You know, what the slave masters taught us during those times that he had us on the plantation, which means that now, as I always say, you can't put black people on the witness stand today because all blacks have bad habits. And, you know, you've seen many cases I've tried, you see, but if you go back in your memory, you have never seen me put a black person on the witness stand.
That's never. True. You've never done that.
Right. You know what I mean? And so what I realized is that you have to go back to the basics and proceed from there. And the people in Cleveland got to go back to the basics. And if they don't understand what the basics are, then they have to bring in a consultant to help them get back on track. You know, because as I say all the time, I think that our community got to understand this. Look, we are a shattered community. But the puzzle has been shattered as a bad omen. But the good part is that all of the pieces of the puzzle are still here. Now, they may not forever be here, but as you and I talk right now, those pieces of the puzzle are still on the table. It only takes somebody who knows how to put the pieces back together to make us beautiful again. But the good part is, at this particular time, the pieces of the puzzle are still there. And that's why we have hope. And that's why we can still win all of this.
But you have a formidable task, the system, and we talk about systems. I talk about systems all the time. The system is organized against progress. It's organized against justice. So with this in mind, how, for example, would you specifically tackle the justice objective in the Tamir Rice case?
Okay, I thought about this last night because, sometimes you have to go deep into your own background for some people to understand just where you came from. And I went back last night to the University of Georgia. And at that particular time, the professor who really saved me over there and allowed me to have an understanding of what the legal system was really about, brought me into his office. And when I got in there, I noticed he had this huge American flag on the wall. And he said to me, "Maddox, this is what they have done to me because they thought that I should have done more to you." And so I got this big American flag on my wall to prove that I'm not a pinko communist. And so in that, he said, "Look, the legal system is a secret society. And unlike many other societies, they don't give you but one chance. It's one and done." He says, "Good possibility that if you stay around here, you're going to be one and done. And this system is going to crush you. And they may have already got enough arsenal together to do it already. I don't know." He said, "But let me give you a few tips." He said, "It's not going to be easy for you to get admitted into the legal profession at this stage. But, there's still some possibility, and you're going to have to try to take it." And that was back in the 1969, Utrecht. And so I then had to plot out a course of action that would enable me, as I had to go through the character committees and I had to go through the judges and all these other people, to get past all of that. And I did. It wasn't easy. People don't understand. It just wasn't a matter of me being admitted because I was already a marked person. But I did it. And, and the point that I'm making is that, planning is everything. I can't sit here right this very moment and tell you exactly what we should be doing, but I can tell you that it starts with planning, and there's a strategy out there that would enable us to get past this as I got past New York. Now, eventually New York caught up with me, and they realized he shouldn't have been practicing law in the first place. And that went back to the University of Georgia. He had skirted us for all these years, and he was an outlaw then, and we're going to treat him as an outlaw now. And that's the reason why the New York legislature stepped in and said, "We got to get rid of him because he should have never been there." But this is my point. We have to plan what our course of action is in this case in Cleveland and elsewhere. And, and out of that plan, I can assure you that we can come up with a plan, like I came up with a plan when I was just one person against the whole legal establishment that got eventually admitted into New York and then into Pennsylvania and then eventually back into Georgia. So, what I'm saying is that the plan is there. It's just a question of us convening and working out the details, putting together the timetable, putting together the strategy, and putting together the tactics.
Does it surprise you that what we've been discussing, and these are strategies and tactics for scoring legal victories and by so doing at least improving the odds of getting some measure of justice in these circumstances that are so unjust, but does it surprise you that the leadership, such as it is, has not yet gotten that point? Or do you think that they have an idea that this is what wake sense, and therefore they're so loyal to the system, they've been so compromised by the system, they're so willing to serve the system, that they too are preaching another way. They're persuading people to move in a whole other direction, because that enhances their importance with regard to the system. The system will have to come through them, and they become the sluices through which things get done.
Yeah, well, I think that when you deal with certain people, you know, and I like to give names to them, especially the people that I know personally, you know, I do know that a lot of them are opportunists. They don't necessarily know the system itself, but they can recognize opportunities to enhance themselves at the expense of others. And so what I will say is that I don't think that a lot of people out here really understand the system, who really know it, but I think they are opportunists, and I think they will take advantage of any opportunity to move in their directions in terms of their own well-being at the expense of the race. And so, you know, when you look at Jesse Jackson in Chicago, you know, there's a common element between Jesse and Al Sharpton and President Obama, for example, and that is Rockefeller. I mean, President Obama was a law professor at Rockefeller University, so to speak. I just use the word Rockefeller University instead of the University of Chicago. And Jesse Jackson was a student at Rockefeller University, and Al Sharpton was a trainee at Rockefeller University. And so, you know, that sort of explains, when you connect those dots, as exactly where all of them are coming from. And we have to get past them, you know, in terms of us scoring hits. And a lot of our people won't get past them. I mean, a lot of our people go to the polls and vote for Hillary Clinton, you know, and all of those folks. And and the question becomes, you know, how fast can we educate our people as to all of the line fields and minefields that are out there before we can get to the promised land?
But still, you are hopeful that things can be done, and you continue to do what you do.
Well, I'm very hopeful because, as I said before, Eutrice, what I do know is that our dreams have been shattered. But I also know that the puzzle is still on the table. It may not be intact, but I'm hopeful that there are people there in the next generation that can put this puzzle back together again. I think the great thing that we have to feel proud of is that we wouldn't let the system destroy the puzzle or any piece of the puzzle, and therefore we have to be hopeful as to outcome.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Alton. And I want to come back and ask you to do one more.
You got
that
it.
Is, we
you
have to close out and do due respect
I
to the
I
last
won't let
remaining
you that.
Case.
No, I won't let you do that. You got it.
Okay. Well, thank you. We will be talking about the Jamar Clark case in Minneapolis tomorrow, and that will close out our closer look at these cases to get an understanding of the legal impediments and the legal strategies that should be employed to get some modicum of justice, not just for these individuals and their families, but in the sense that Alton Maddox was talking about, which is as a class, because this really is a true class struggle, and people need to understand that. Now, just that recognition should be enough to change people's attitudes and minds about these cases. This is not about police officers behaving badly. This is a continuum of the struggle that African Americans have had, and we continue to face a system absolutely dedicated to denying justice to this class. Thank you for joining me today. I hope this was useful to you. You would let me know, I hope. Send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. Stay tuned right here at PRN.FM. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. I want to thank those of you who have started your study groups and those who are about to start study groups based on the program. It's incredibly heartwarming to me to know that you're doing that, and I thank you so much for really lifting my spirits about it, that you find the program that important and that valuable. So thank you so much for that. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.